back to the office or not? How you feel? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday today, January 3rd. Good as always to have you along, everybody. As we begin the first work week of 2022, a very quick nod up at the top here to the economic calendar the next couple of days. Labor market intensive is the spoiler alert. Tomorrow, it's JOLTS, the Job Opening and Labor Turnover Survey, a look at how many people left their jobs in November. As you know, there have been millions quitting of late. And then on Friday, the December unemployment report. Jobs, as we say around here, are the whole smash in this economy right now. Calendars and schedules in general are, of course, very much on the minds of the traveling public at the moment, the air traveling public, to be precise, facing as they are weather and Omicron-induced delays and cancellations all over the place. And to that list of delays, one might also add telecommunications policy. Verizon and AT&T are getting set, as you might have heard, to launch new 5G service in dozens of cities this week. That promise of faster data, though, comes with a safety warning from airlines and the FAA. Marketplace's Lily Jamali gets us going.
Verizon and AT&T say they've addressed the FAA's safety concerns in at least one key area by curtailing 5G frequencies near airports and helipads for 6 months. In a letter on Sunday to the FAA, the company said this and other accommodations were voluntary and, quote, in the spirit of compromise. Harold Feld is Senior Vice President of Public Knowledge, a tech advocacy group.
I really feel like the FAA did not seem to realize that it could put its foot down and things would still move ahead.
The FAA's request for an additional delay stems from concerns that whenever it's deployed, the frequencies 5G uses, called the C-band, are going to interfere with altimeters, which help airplanes land. That's too important, says Sarah Nelson, president of the Association of Flight Attendants.
We will not make crews and the traveling public guinea pigs on whether or not this system is safe.
Nelson warns that moving ahead could mean grounding flights, the last thing many airlines want right now after the holiday season that was. Some observers see this as a clash between federal agencies. The FAA is up against the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, whose mandate is to make 5G happen. Jeff Westling is with the American Action Forum. He says it's the FCC that's the expert agency here.
They have looked at these claims and they've essentially rejected them, saying they've looked at all the data and don't think there's any chance of harmful interference.
Also, the telecom companies say 5G and aviation already coexist safely in other parts of the world. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, stocks up, mostly, sure, yes, but bonds, y'all. I know I keep saying it, but bonds. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. What was that saying about Wall Street maybe 20, 30 years ago? Masters of the Universe, right? From the Tom Wolfe book? Well, it's tough, I imagine, to bring that off if you're wearing sweatpants and sitting in your kitchen on a Zoom, which helps explain why Wall Street's biggest banks have been among the most aggressive in getting people back to the office. That, however, was a couple of letters back in the Greek alphabet, and Omicron's got many of the big investment banks once again telling people to stay home as cases surge in New York City. J.P. Morgan and Citigroup a couple of days ago, Goldman yesterday. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on that one.
Companies from Google to Chevron have also been rethinking their return-to-office plans, but in banking?
It's a reluctant work from home, and they want the people to come back in February.
MIT lecturer Robert Posen, a former investment banking executive, says in-person work will always be the gold standard in the industry, from making deals to mentoring junior bankers. But the longer remote work goes on,
the idea of everyone coming in 5 days a week and working from 8 till 10 p.m., I think that we're not going to have that anymore.
Wall Street banks have made record profits during the pandemic, with most people working from home. Yet many industry leaders have seemed resistant to change, says Sadal Neely at Harvard Business School.
It's very difficult to call something that's lasted 2 years, that's changed how you work, that's changed how you've recruited and retained, an aberration or temporary.
It's also difficult to predict when COVID won't be an issue anymore. So employers need to be transparent and nimble, says Bhushan Sethi with business service firm PwC.
If your long-term plan is to still be office-based, is to really push that and talk about whether that's more testing, changing the definition of vaccinations, the need for not just masks, but maybe N95 masks in the office.
Many of the banks already require employees to be vaccinated, and some, including Goldman Sachs, will now require boosters when employees return in a matter of weeks, supposedly. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
The price of natural gas was up today about 3.25% or so at the New York Mercantile Exchange, part of a trend in prices that is both domestic and international. And those prices and the related increases in global and domestic nat gas demand is having the expected market-based effect. The energy industry, here in the United States specifically, is ramping up its capacity to export natural gas in liquid form. The thing is, the facilities that can do that, liquefy gas, are expensive, and with many pledges everywhere to stop using fossil fuels altogether and do it sooner rather than later, well, you can see the big capital investment conundrum, right? Marketplace's Andy Euler took a visit to natural gas country in Louisiana.
The boom in demand for natural gas makes perfect sense. A retired dairy farmer named Don Fisher explained to me as he drank coffee with his buddies one morning in Stonewall, Louisiana. It's a small town about 20 miles south of Shreveport. Now, this part of Louisiana produced about 13% of the country's natural gas in 2020, and it projects to produce even more in the coming years. Fisher is now living on income from contracts that he has with energy companies that extract natural gas from thousands of feet below his family's pasture.
It's a blessing for us. Yeah, it's a blessing.
Fisher says gas is also a blessing for the country as a whole as it pivots to renewable energy sources.
Think about where you would be without natural gas to produce power. I mean, you'd be dependent on coal, and coal doesn't work with solar or wind because solar and wind both quit. Coal, it takes all day to restart. Gas, you can crank up in 15 minutes.
The U.S. is not the only country making that transition. And since the U.S. produces more gas than it uses, some of it ends up here. At Cheniere Energy's Sabine Pass liquefaction facility in Cameron, Louisiana, about 4 hours south of Fisher's farmland. Once pipelines deliver the gas to this 853-acre complex, it's cooled until it liquefies, which shrinks its volume by 600 times. Then it gets loaded onto ocean-going tanker ships that carry it to Europe, China, all over the world. Now, American energy companies want to make sure that they can keep meeting that demand as it grows, so they're expanding. This Sabine Pass facility is already one of the largest liquefied natural gas or LNG plants in the world. Cheniere is hoping to add another 20% more capacity.
What they recognize is the economic demand that's being placed on the industry.
That's Dan Brouillette. He served as U.S. Energy Secretary under President Donald Trump, and he's now president of Sempra Infrastructure, the majority owner of another large LNG plant in Louisiana. Down the road, forklifts are moving steel pipes at a new LNG export terminal. The owner, Venture Global, said in early December that it's pumping another $10 billion into yet another LNG export facility next to this one. It makes sense. In October, China's state oil company Sinopec signed two 20-year deals to buy a combined 4 million tons of LNG per year from Venture Global. Now, building these facilities is expensive. We're talking billions. Energy companies borrow to pay for them. Brad Williams at Spitfire Energy Advisors says lenders want to see enough long-term contracts to guarantee that they're going to get their money back.
Just like buying a car, right? The lender just wants to make sure that they're going to get their money back plus their interest. Same thing with a big energy infrastructure project. They're just bigger numbers.
And with natural gas prices higher than they've been in years, Dan Briette says investors don't want to miss out on an opportunity to cash in.
So raising capital for these very capital intensive projects has not really been that much of a challenge to the industry. I think that sends a strong signal of confidence that this is going to be around for a while.
Ah, now there's the rub. Exactly how long is a while? Joshua Rhodes at UT Austin says net zero carbon emission goals are important. Now, we can't get there right away, but natural gas could be an important bridge that helps us get there.
I do think it is going to play, you know, a role in the short to medium term for sure.
Short term for Rhodes is 10 years, medium 20 to 30. He says right now, LNG companies should be doing what they can to produce gas as cleanly as possible. That means limiting methane leaks and the amount that they're flaring.
If I were telling, you know, a natural gas company what to do, I would say, well, do the best to future-proof your product. I mean, make it as tight and as clean as possible. While it's not maybe great for the environment, it's at least better than what the alternative is.
He says LNG buyers in Europe and Asia will measure gas companies, at least in part, on how much they pollute. And that could have meaningful implications for their future bottom lines. In Hackberry, Louisiana, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace. Coming up,
sound is almost like a magic trick in my mind.
Almost, yeah. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 246 today on the point scale, 0.6%, 36,585. The NASDAQ up 187, about 1.2%, 15,832. The S&P 500 boosted 30 points, about 0.6%, 47.96. Andy Euler was just telling us about the nat gas boom. The U.S. Energy Information Administration, citing the S&P Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, says overall energy prices up nearly 60% by the end of 2021 from where they began on the first trading day of 2021. Go figure that out. Electric car maker Tesla jump-started the year with the announcement it delivered 936,000 cars last year, 87% higher than 2020. Tesla revved up 13.5% today. I mentioned bonds. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.63%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As of the last official count, there were more than 580,000 homeless people in this economy. That count, though, was 2 years ago, January of 2020. And the people who study this say the number has almost certainly grown during the pandemic. About 25% of America's homeless population lives in California, more than 11,000 people in the capital, Sacramento. And that reality and the spread of tent camps on city streets there has prompted Sacramento's mayor to propose that that city become the first in the country to declare a right to housing. Marketplace's Matt Levin explains what that might really mean.
Michael Hagee says he's been homeless for 5 years. Today, he's inside a one-person camping tent on 15th Street in Midtown Sacramento, across from a craft brewery and a quality inn.
Yeah, I take Seroquels.
Okay.
For schizophrenic and bipolar.
You do? Okay.
Yes. So now
are you able to take your meds now?
I'm not even functioning. No, because I can't pay for them.
It's clear Hagee could use medical attention. He takes off a wet sock to show me a swollen right foot with only two full toes. He says in the past he was addicted to meth.
Has anyone come around here and offered you either a bed in a shelter?
No, I'm scared to go to wood.
Hagee says he's had bad experiences with other shelter residents. At least six tents have lined the east side of 15th Street since April. The sidewalk isn't blocked, but piles of trash spill over into the street. Mario Gonzalez had to assign his employees at Chondo's Cantina a new role, morning street sweeper. The Mexican restaurant and nightclub is less than 50 feet from the encampment.
Every single morning, my team members, they have to clean it up. It's so hard.
That frustration you hear in Gonzalez's voice, you hear that from business owners all over the city. Compassion fatigue is settling in. Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg feels like he's in a race against time.
If we do not make this better, someone will come along and write an initiative that will be draconian, that will be inhumane.
He could see even progressive California getting regressive with tactics that involve more law enforcement and criminal penalties, which is why last month Steinberg proposed a pretty radical solution. Treat housing like public education, a legal right.
The law requires us to provide free public education to kids, and thus requires us to build public schools. Housing people is as important as we say it is. Shouldn't the same right and obligation on us exist?
Sacramento's right to housing would work like this. If the city doesn't have enough homeless housing, and right now it's thousands of beds short, a homeless person could sue the city. Steinberg hopes a court order would speed the construction of new housing, cutting through red tape. Advocates for homeless people are mostly supportive of the idea, except for one controversial part.
So I think it's coming from a good place, but the obligation to accept, I'm stuck on.
Deborah Padgett is a professor of social work at NYU. Steinberg's plan would get every person experiencing homelessness a choice, maybe a shelter, maybe a motel room. If the person who is homeless still refused, they would be forced to move from their current location.
Well, they're going to move, but they're still going to be out on the streets and they'll start an encampment somewhere. So you're just pushing the problem down the road a bit, literally.
Padgett fears right to housing could easily morph into right to shelter, New York State's policy since the 1970s court case. Right to shelter did get people indoors, but Padgett says it didn't get enough people into permanent housing. It just got them stuck in a homelessness cycle.
People are living out their lives for years, going from shelter to street. It's a horrible way of living.
Mayor Steinberg is showing me the latest shelter the city has constructed, a so-called sprung shelter, rapidly constructed housing that was put together in just a few months. It's got 90 beds and there's a dining room and laundry services.
People say, well, New York tried that and failed just because they did it in a way that was not up to the kind of quality standards and dignity standards that we would expect doesn't mean that we can't do it right here.
Right to housing was greeted warmly by the city council, which will likely vote on it later this year. There's no estimated price tag yet, but Steinberg says whatever the dollar figure comes out to be, it'll be far less than what homelessness is costing a city right now. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Smells, as I think a lot of us know, can be really evocative. They can take you right back to that time or that place. Also, though, sounds. Corporate sounds, to be specific. Less emotional, sure, but some of them are so recognizable that you don't even need me to ID them for you. NBC, right? NBC. How about this one? I am not a Siri fan, by the way.
Okay.
Those sounds and the creative effort and corporate strategy behind them are part of what Dallas Taylor covers in an ongoing podcast he does called 20,000 Hertz. Dallas, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Could you do me a little definition thing here, right? Sonic branding versus sonic logos. I feel like we might need some help.
They're kind of interchangeable. Yeah. So sonic branding, sonic logos. A sonic logo, I would probably define more as something like a Netflix to dumb or a HBO Static Angel. Where I might call like sonic branding something that might even be like a text message sound.
Sorry, HBO Sonic, what's Static Angel? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, so So HBO, you know, that classic kind of like staticky sound that goes into this. Well, it's cool because what they were, so back in the 80s, there was this revolutionary new kind of television thing that was beamed up in satellites. Mm-hmm. And so they were trying to communicate that this is not TV, it's something special. And so the most quintessential sound that they could come up with back in the 80s for that would represent television would be TV static. And then they kind of built out this this kind of synth harmonic thing that transports you into this whole new world.
You know, it's so interesting that so much thought goes into these things, because you hear it and you're like, okay, my HBO show is coming on, or you know, my Netflix show is coming on. Would you walk us through, as briefly as you can, because this was like a 20-minute podcast you did last year, the Netflix Ta-Dum and how that sort of came to be? Because it's so amazingly intentional for like 3 seconds of audio.
Right. So they're coming off this long history of like film, big film logos. So if you think of like the 20th century Fox logo or the THX sound, mm-hmm. or Leo the Lion even, yeah. they knew that if they played some long thing that it would just, people would tune out. And in the age of streaming, you want this like click and play and immediate effect. And so what they were trying to solve was this kind of idea of like, ta-dum, it's Netflix. And so so the story of that sound in particular was Lon Bender, which was a sound designer, and he basically hit his ring finger up against a cabinet, sweetened it, which is a very sound designer-y term for add other sounds to it to make it sound cooler. It was short, but it didn't really like have a payoff. And so one of his sound designer colleagues, Charlie Campagna, just happened to pull out this reversed guitar track that he had made 2 decades prior. Basically put the two together, and it was ta-dong.
Ooh, that was
and
really
it was,
good.
That was really good, actually.
It's funny because there's a little bit of serendipity in that story, but a whole lot of intentionality. But here's why we wanted to talk to you. You know, companies have been visually branding their stuff forever, right? But as we now move more fully into the digital space, those digital audio branding things that are so short and snappy but work on the, as you said, click and play thing, are becoming all the more important.
Mm-hmm. Sound is almost like a magic trick in my mind, because it's something we don't think about a lot. We think about all of our other senses very intentionally. You know, we have food channels and we have, you know, we love curating our clothes and things that are comfy and blah, blah, blah. But sound is something that humans culturally, at least now, don't think a lot about. But it has this really powerful ability to prime your brain for what's coming. Or into whatever world this brand is trying to put you. Mm-hmm. And now we have, you were in the very first generations of putting speakers millimeters from our ear, you know, our eardrums.
Yeah.
We're kind of at a dawn of a new era with sound because of that. And I think that's why so many brands and people are starting to think about that emotional prime.
All right. So let me play one for you now. And it's, let's see, 89, 32 years old. Let me see what you think. What do you think? What do you think?
I recognize it somewhere, actually. What I love about that is immediately it makes me think of like a kind of like a church bell in the middle of a town square saying something's happening. You know, like we're about to gather communally. Huh. And so I think it's just a really classic way to like bring people together and go, okay, we're doing something together.
Excellent. We're going to go out on that one. I'm going to take the win for the Marketplace Gong. Dallas Taylor, he runs a podcast called 20,000 Hertz. It's kind of amazing, actually, and you should listen to that Netflix episode. Dallas, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
This final note today, go ahead and pour one out for the BlackBerry. You might have missed this, distracted as we were by the pandemic when the company announced back in September of 2020 that it was going to stop supporting the once ubiquitous devices. But it is effective tomorrow. BlackBerry's basically become bricks. So if you somehow do still have one, well, I'm pretty sure there's an Apple store somewhere near you, right? Speaking of which, and related, at one point today, one share of Apple would have cost you $182.85, which for just one brief moment put its market capitalization, which is, remember, share price times total shares outstanding, put that market cap on the far side of $3 trillion from where the rest of us live. The first American company to go there closed just shy of $3 trillion, Apple did. And you know what that means? It means Apple's worth about $3 trillion. That and a couple of bucks get you on the subway. All right, we're leaving, but here is your moment of economic context, a moment that might have changed money as we know it. January 3rd, 2009, 13 years ago today, the very first link, if you will, the Genesis block on the Bitcoin blockchain was mined. Here we are 13 years later. Crypto is definitely real. Bitcoin itself, still kind of speculative, right? One Bitcoin today would run you about $46,000. Not too long ago, $64,000 apiece, practically. Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Ria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios are the production staff on this program. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.